now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Daryl Hamamoto. Daryl Hamamoto, formerly professor of California Davis, he is a recognized leading scholar in U.S. media and popular culture. His contributions include monographs on television, situation comedy, Asian Americans on TV, and essay collections on related subjects. Professor Hamamoto has addressed issues of sexuality in both scholarly research and creative work. He has been the subject of a documentary titled Masters of the Pillow. Corporate media have featured his exercises in culture hacking on programs including The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Fox News, and The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. His most recent book is Servitors of Empire, Studies in the Dark Side of Asian America. It is a startling departure from academic orthodoxy in that each chapter examines the misdeeds of Asian Americans at the highest levels of business, the military, academia, and politics. Currently, Professor Hamamoto is working on a book concerning Anglo-American elite sexuality. It ranges from a survey of President John F. Kennedy's lovers during the 1960s to deep research into the circumstances surrounding the death of Diana Spencer in 1997. The book concludes with a study of British and American co-depravity that centers upon the figure of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And his book is Servitors of Empire, Studies in the Dark Side of Asian America. Daryl Hamamoto, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, James. Thank you for the invitation to appear on your show. Your audience is very, very lucky. They're in for a really nice treat today.
Well, thank you for the plug on the Alex Jones show. People started contacting me and telling me that, one of the guests there mentioned my name and my work on the Alex Jones show, and I kind of did a double take, and then turned out it was you. Thank you so much for that, Daryl. Now, we've got so much to talk about. Could you tell our listening audience, to begin with, a bit about yourself and how you wound up in the UC system as a professor, and how you came to write the book that you did, Servitors of Empire?
I graduated with a degree in political science at Cal State Long Beach. I wasn't smart enough to get into the UC. The truth is that I wanted to play music, and Cal State Long Beach had a really, really good music program. The Carpenters studied there for a couple of years before they hit big, and any number of people in the Los Angeles region. And from there, and I'm telling this because I have a penchant for pursuing oddball academic disciplines, and I've pioneered at least three of them, and this is the third one right here. This is the hat trick, which I call New World Order Studies. But I went off to Bowling Green, Ohio, and I studied at Bowling Green State University in the very first Department of Popular Culture Studies, and I earned an MA there. And I did this is back in 1976. No one was looking at popular culture except for this program in the Midwest. This is around the Toledo area, and that department's still in existence. Since then, of course, there are any number of supposed experts. I'm saying supposed because most of them do it as a hobby, as opposed to me, who this is my primary focus. And then I got into sexuality studies. So this is something that's been a preoccupation since I became an adolescent, as it is for most people. And I wanted to study sexuality primarily because it seemed like the academic feminists had claimed that for their own monopoly. And also the budding gay and lesbian movement hijacked it for their own. And I wanted to talk about heterosexuality. I wanted to talk about erotica. And I did that. I wrote a landmark essay. I won't repeat the title of it because I don't know what the regulations are for your network. But there's a four-letter word in there, and it's a play on the words of the Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. So I'll let your audience use their imagination. And one of my students approached me to make a documentary, and I did make the first all-Asian American erotic film. And I have these trolls and these defamers who try to hold that against me. I'm proud of it. They say, well, he made a porno movie. Well, they don't get the point. It's, for one thing, it's an erotic film with a message. And I guess some of these numbskulls don't really get it. And the message was, hey, and James, you know, you've lived in the U.S. for most of your life, right? But up until recently, there are almost zero Asian American males, right, on television and film. So I said, hey, you know, I'm going to do something really truly radical here. I'm going to make the first all-Asian American. By the way, that includes adult entertainment as well. So I knew this. I did the study. I researched the article. It was published in a real live academic journal, for what's that's worth. And by the way, a lot of this work was inspired by my students, and I'll talk about them shortly, because the University of California, realizing the impact I've had on the new generation of students, has deigned to ban me from campus for the second time in 3 years. So I'm sitting here with you today on leave from the University of California, Davis. And I'll give you the email address a little bit later on to Chancellor Hexter, so you could fill up his mailbox with a lot of messages about me. But first of all, I'll prove my mettle to you before you go ahead and do that. So I've been interested in, okay, that's the second major innovation that I've done. And most academics, by the way, are lucky if they even make one significant original contribution to the field. Most of them make zero. It's about 80% have the zero impact, about 20%. So that's number two. Number three is what we're going to be talking about today, and I just call it New World Order Studies. And, of course, your work is germane to that, and that's why I name-checked you on the Alex Jones Show. I think your work is pioneering. It's important. I know it's a work in progress. So is mine. Anybody who claims, even if they're a physicist, that they know everything that remains in their field is lying, correct? We're always finding new species and making new discoveries. This is in the hard sciences. We even had a planet that was demoted a few years ago. First, there were 9 planets. All of a sudden, we only have 8 planets. So if you get my point, it's a work in progress. But anyway, your work is very, very crucial to what I've been looking at recently. And that's this seemingly, as it turns out, it's a long-term project, if I understand your work correctly. But the seeming sudden appearance of these so-called SJWs, social justice warriors. I won't dignify them with the term warrior. I'll just say SJWs, the W standing for wannabes, because they are not who they seem they are, who they appear to be. These people are controlled assets. And controlled has numerous connotations, of course. And I wanted to ask you some questions about the nature of their control that stems back to a lot of their multi-general experience in military families. That really...
Yes, please, by all means.
Absolutely, and that really came to light when I saw this one figure, and she's a public figure. She's gone on Fox News, so we're not libeling her or slandering her. I'm just making a comment on who she is and what she represents. But I saw this figure called Yvette Felarca. And she's Filipina. She's Filipino-American. I bet you anything that if we looked into her background, she's a Navy brat, you know, and I'm sure she grew up in Alameda or some of the area. She's in Oakland, Berkeley area, and she's been appearing on Fox News, and she was interviewed at length by Tucker Carlson of Fox News. He laughed in her face. She was very offended by that. Anyway, she's the new face of these creatures, these constructions that we had thrown at us recently. And my prediction is that she's going to disappear from the scene shortly because her handlers are finding out that all she has done is inspired resistance to the movement that she's been trained to represent. And that movement is nothing less than the overthrow of the American Republic and to fuse the United States of America with all the other sovereign nations of the world, hence New World Order.
We've seen this shtick before. It's been rebranded, it's been repackaged, but when we go back to the old Komsomol Communist Youth Movement, the Communist International, the Patrice Lumumba University, where you had people of all different races indoctrinated in socialism, cultural Marxism, communism, and these would be people from the subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Asia, China, you name it. They were all there, and Westerners, Europeans as well. And then they would just be turned loose on the world. Classic agitprop, agitation propaganda. So the shtick, the modus operandi is the same. They've just kind of rebranded it. And what they've done, Daryl, it seems to me, and I'd like your thoughts on this, they seem to have done their homework as far as psychological profiling is concerned. They find these people, in our example, like this gal you just described, another example...
Yvette Falarca.
Yvette Falarca, another example would be the alleged shooter, Virginia Tech University, Cho, a classic example, South Korean, his family, in all likelihood, talent spotted, recruited by intelligence in South Korea, family brought wholesale to the U.S., the daughter wound up working with a defense contractor connected, I think, to the NSA, and then, surprise, surprise, this Cho guy supposedly goes out and shoots up a bunch of people in Virginia Tech. It smells of black ops from here to there. And so it seems to me that they're finding these disaffected youth, these empty vessels. They fit a certain psych profile of a narcissist sociopath, and they give them financing. And for once, they get to dress up and share the power, Daryl. And then they know that they've got their back, the powers that be, as far as avoiding arrest, as far as media publicity is concerned. Then they just turn these people loose.
Absolutely. And you notice that... the university and schools are more are increasingly becoming the site of these types of incidents. And I've been warning my institution and academia in general that this is going to happen, right? Because we saw a similar situation occurred down at the UC Santa Barbara area, a guy named Elliot Roger, right? His mother was, I think, Thai, and his father was, quote-unquote, a director. He's a British citizen, I believe. In the Santa Barbara, Isla Vista area, and he shot and stabbed to death and wounded and killed a number of people, including his roommates, by the way, who were all Asian, right? They're from overseas. They were international students, as they call them. So we're seeing more and more of the Asian American young people being brought into this. And typically, prior to this, most of America's viewed Asian Americans as being innocuous, inoffensive, and invisible, just like I told you about the movies, right? We're just not there. And they do fit a certain characterological, psychological, if you will, profile. They're highly suggestible. You call them empty vessels. But there's one dimension that I wanted to interject. I want to keep this vector really in the forefront of our discussion here. And that's their subjection to psychotropic drugs, hallucinogens.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I mention this is because I've been campaigning against this relentlessly to my students. And by the way, John Rappaport gave a really great, like a one-hour excursus on the university's becoming a psychiatric facility. And he's not exaggerating because over 25%, and it's higher for women, are on some sort of psychotropics. I'm affected by this in class. I've been teaching for... at Davis for 20 years. I've been teaching about 30 years totally. I've seen the students becoming more zombified for the lack of, well, I have technical terms for it, but I'll just say zombified. And the problem is that I ran smack dab in the middle of one of the proponents. He calls it Asian American mental health. His name is Nolan Zane, Z-A-N-E, if you want to look him up. And there's a whole history of so-called community health in the United States. You mentioned LBJ, right?
Yes.
But even prior to LBJ, there was something called the Community Health Initiative that started under the Kennedy administration. And I won't go into this that deeply because it might not be of interest to your audience. But anyway, it has its roots in the so-called Great Society, the New Frontier. That's where all these community health programs had their genesis, and one of them was farmed out Well, for one thing, they were farmed out to the four major groups: African American, Asian American, Native American, and Latino. So they had a front man for each one. And the front man there was a guy named K. Patrick Okura, who came out of the concentration camps for Japanese Americans during World War II. And he was brought into Boys Town, of all places. You know Father Flanagan's?
Oh, yes.
Right. And I don't need to tell your audience. All they have to do is mention Boys Town, and they can fill in the gaps, right, with John Van de Kamp and Nick Bryant. They've written two great books on that. So there's a whole conditioning, child abuse, pedophilia connection there that is at the very genesis of Asian American mental health. And I teach this in class. I made a vow to myself years ago that I would tell the truth in the class, and I, wherever it may take us. And unfortunately, this guy, Nolan Zane, who runs Asian American Mental Health, has to protect this decades-long cash cow that's administered by the so-called National Institute of Health. It's a misnomer. It's a deceptive term, if I've ever heard one. By the way, I don't mean to discount the reality of serious mental illness. There are people that are profoundly psychotic, and I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about the growing population of perfectly normal individuals who've been labeled, who've been pathologized and herded into this American and now global psychiatric system. That's where it's going. So I ran into problems with this guy. He framed me about 3 years ago. I was banned from campus under some bogus pretext. He's been trying to get me fired ever since then. And the University of California, Davis, has been going along with it, and I finally sniffed this out after a number of years studying it, is because University of California, Davis is ground zero for any number of similar type programs, including one that your audience will have heard about. It's called Jonestown.
Uh-huh.
Right? And there's a fine doctoral dissertation. The title, I think, was Jonestown a CIA operation? You might be able to find it online. I don't think it was ever published as a book, but it's in a dissertation, and it's available in many university libraries. For now, I suggest you get a copy before it's pulled off the shelves. The more I read, the more I tried to figure out my personal predicament and why the university and why this one guy in particular was coming at me so aggressively, the more I was able to lay bare the musculature, the skeletal system, the central nervous system of the University of California system itself. So what's happened, this is the good news, what's happened is that the more they tried to repress me, the stronger I came, and the more mentally acute and sharpened and attuned I came to realities that they have been trying to deny students and denying professors themselves. And most professors are utterly ignorant of path-breaking work such as yours, that it's so, I think, indispensable to understanding the predicament we're in. Donald Trump and himself, Trumpism, that particular victory is only one aspect of the transformation that we need. We need a complete transformation of our knowledge base, our understanding, our appreciation of the sciences, the humanities, all forms of human knowledge and experience, including, as we'll talk about later, hopefully, the spirit realm, which has been systematically denied students at the university in exchange for this technocratic form of knowledge grouped around disciplines known as STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Almost exclusively, almost all of the funding goes into this area to the exclusion of work such as yours, work that traditionally was handled by the literature department or history or even the social sciences. All of them have been completely subverted by the Carnegie Commission, the Rockefeller Commission. These are the people that have warped higher education, in addition to the centralization of university funding by certain departments like the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense. We're talking about the United States here, but I'm sure there's similar systems in place throughout the English-speaking world. In fact, at the highest level, I'm sure it's all integrated. So that's how I came into your work. I'm completely open to forms of knowledge that most academics wouldn't look twice at. They think it's beneath them. I think it's a big mistake, because if you really want to trace it back, and I've done this on other programs prior to this one, if you really want to trace it back, the university itself began as a occult institution, and it never lost it. Only they pretended they're doing science. And again, I don't mean to denigrate the great contributions that science has brought forth to enhance our civilization, right? That's not what I'm saying here. I'm saying that a lot of it has been perverted and diverted and has been operationalized to destroy a great deal of our civilization, our culture, and the people within it, the populations, the individuals within it. They tried it with me, by the way. I was groomed, if you will, from a very young age, because you've talked a lot about your early childhood experience. I'll just leave you with this one anecdote, and that is at a very young age in high school, I was identified as being, I don't know, above average or something. I wasn't getting good grades. I think I was a C student. I was identified. I wrote for the school newspaper. I wrote really a lot of interesting articles. I was doing this since I was in fifth grade, really, and I always wanted to be a writer, so I had these skills. And I was recruited to become a member of the very first ever academic decathlon. This is in Orange County, California. Dr. Robert Peterson, who was the superintendent of schools, came up with this idea of the academic decathlon. And I didn't really understand why they picked me for it, because I wasn't particularly a shining star in the classroom, except in history and reading and all that. I really didn't care a lot for the sciences. So I've been tracked ever since then. I've had different types of fellowships and scholarships, and I never really kind of understood why me. And then finally, I understand they were trying to get me on their side. But unfortunately, we'll talk about this later, hopefully. Unfortunately, I grew up, I was socialized in a different world. I grew up in the 1950s. So I was watching a lot of popular culture movies like High Noon with Gary Cooper, yes. 1952, you know? I grew up with all the Americana movies and the music, and we started to mock it in the 60s, you know, with the hippies and the counterculture. And we thought, oh, that's uncool. Let's tune in, turn out, and drop out, right? But I've come full circle, and I realize, and you've talked about this on your other programs, about the counterculture being a giant psyop funded by a lot of the alphabet agencies, right? So I've taken away the best part, I think, of the counterculture revolution, but I've also understood that the Americana that I grew up in was purposely undercut and destroyed by an entire, my generation, really, the so-called baby booms, in order to foul the nest of the younger generation, including the millennials. What we're seeing, though, amongst that group, and that's the group I teach, by the way. That's why it's so important for me to be in the classroom. And that's the reason why the University of California, Davis has banned me from the classroom for the past 2 out of 3 years, is that they need this type of generational continuity that I can pass on to them. In the Japanese language, the term is called a sensei, or in the Cantonese pronunciation in the Chinese language, it's a shifu. I assume it's pronounced right. And it's the same character. And what it means is the generation, right? The generation that follows. There's a notion of reproduction, generativity that one generation passes on to the next one. So that's me. I'm a sensei. All right. And you know your Asian cultures, and you know your so-called traditional cultures. And it's always people that occupy this position that are most valued within that culture, within that social system. In America, that's not true. In Britain, it's not true. In the Anglo-American world, we have been made into laughingstocks. We've been made into non-entities. We're the second most reviled group besides the American dad, the American father. So you can see any group that's being mocked and made fun of by the Hollywood elite in their own minds as being really the sources of strength. And energy in that particular society. So I'm dealing with that. I have to grapple with these realities in the university. And let me shift focus slightly. We mentioned Yvette Falarca, and this is someone that just came to my attention courtesy of Masaki Miyagawa, right? You know who he is. You've had him on your show.
Great guy.
And Great guide. I'll take this opportunity for your audience if they want any sort of consultation, or he has good, really good products and services that he provides. You can just hit him on Al-Qaeda, and he can look on, or your audience can look on his website. Anyway, Masaki introduced me to this artist by the name of Mel Chin, right? C-H-I-N. And I guess he's, Kent, his family were immigrants from probably southern China. Chin typically is a Cantonese speaking. It's M-E-L-C-H-I-N, if you want to look it up. He's all over YouTube. Anyway, Masaki sent me a link to him because we've had this conversation between ourselves privately for quite some time now. And what Mel Chin managed to pull off, and your audience is going to be, I think, astounded by this. Let me look at my notes here. He was bragging about in this link that Masaki sent me about how he was able to put his conceptual artwork into this, I don't know how to, it wasn't a sitcom, it's like a weekly drama. It's called Melrose Place. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I never watched it myself. Maybe I should go back, but I kind of understand what the premise. It's kind of like a soap opera, in a way, a primetime soap opera. But what this guy, Mel Chin, did with his artwork, he put in these subliminals into quite a number of scenes. Stylized condoms, for example. He put the molecular structure of the birth control pill on a blanket. Right. And he talks about this himself. He's bragging about it and on and on and on. And more recently, we've learned about this creature called Maria Abramovich. Right.
Oh, yes.
Around it. So
spirit, whatever the hell she calls her artwork.
Spirit cooking.
That's it.
Yes, absolutely. So the high arts themselves, the gallery arts, which, again, are federally funded, just like Asian American mental health. It's the feds. It's the groups that control these entities, like the National Endowment for the Arts. And notice President Trump, that's one of his first executive orders. He said, no more National Endowment for the Arts, no more National Endowment for the Humanities. And again, I'm not against the arts. I'm pro the arts. I'm not against the humanities. I consider myself a humanist, so I'm not against the humanities. But I am against state-controlled arts and state-controlled humanities and state-controlled health. So, yeah, so Mel Chin is part of that network, and you have to be a specially groomed person in order to get all these really sweet grants, right? These are not grants that I get anymore. They tried to groom me, and they realized, hey, we're not getting an adequate return on our investment on Hamamoto. You know, they probably have a spreadsheet on me or something. So let's pull the plug on them. So I don't even apply for them anymore. But I used to get them. I've got the Rockefeller, you know, blah, 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 right? It's all on my resume. And it helped me. You asked how I got in the University of California? That's how I got in there, because I had all the prestigious awards that they dole out to people, even those that don't even deserve it. I mean, look at Barry Sotoro.
Oh, yeah.
The guy's, I mean, he has no intellectual content at all. He's supposedly a law professor and the head of the law review at Harvard Law, and he's never written a single law essay in his life to this very day. All right, so that proves my point about how these people are groomed to identify. You know, maybe I could have been the first president of the United States if I had played my cards right. Who knows? But I'm just kidding. I'm not interested. So anyway, this guy, Mel Chin, is on the horizon. Check him out. On the other hand, he's from Houston, Texas. On the other hand, another guy, I think he was from Houston as well, his name's Mark Lombardi. He's, as a young artist, I think he was seen as up and coming and promising. He might have scored a few grants and might have made it to different types of awards ceremonies. But somewhere along the line, he began to piece together the structure. I think being in Texas and Houston and being observing the Bush family in specific led him to certain conclusions. And he came up with these artworks where he was doing these social networks, these diagrams connecting people from Bin Laden family to George Bush, right? And your audience knows that this web of interconnectivity exists. We know, for example, there's a web of interconnectivity that relates almost all of the American presidents to the royal houses of Britain, including Barry, Sotoro, and Clinton. We know that. So genealogy and bloodlines are very important. And speaking of bloodlines, I refer you to the brilliant work of Lorraine Moret. Check out her website, M-O-R-E-T, Lorraine. And she and I have this interview about the Iranian bloodlines that your audience might want to check out. So these genealogies of power, these bloodlines are really, really crucial when we're talking about this, as is race and ethnicity. And I think now it's the Asian American turn in the bucket to create these different controlled assets like MailChimp and Yvette Flarka. Those are only two that I'm. Oh, I should finish my story about Marco Lombardi. He was suicided. He committed suicide. Supposedly he was depressed. And this book, I can't remember the author of it, but if you look up Marco Lombardi, it's an excellent book, by the way. You can get the full details, but she alludes or hints at the fact that the Bush family might have been behind the so-called suicide of Mark Lombardi. So I'm giving you two extremes. People like Maria Abramovich, who are bringing forth the satanic agenda, the death cult forward, and helping to bond this elite in Washington, D.C., in the state capitals, including the state of California, and including the University of California. They'll bring those people forward. But people like Mark Lombardi, also an artist who should be getting all these grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, those people are eliminated. And the same is true for academia. I can name you at least two or three people at the University of California who have been ostracized and defunded and almost fired, their careers ruined because they did not produce the type of results that their funding agencies wanted. Number one on my list is Peter Duisberg, biologist, I believe, by training at the University of California, who was the first academic to question the AIDS narrative that was being promoted by the insurgent GLBT movement, right? That was their cause célèbre. It was going to be their quote-unquote Holocaust to gain sympathy. So that was Peter Duisberg, he's not my attorney currently, he defended him and helped save his job. He was already tenured. By the way, tenure, just for your listeners, your audience, you don't know the realities behind academia, tenure doesn't mean anything, okay? Because that's the first question I get is, well, gee, you have tenure. How can they do this to you? You're asking the wrong question. I'm giving you the answer to how it really works on ground level. It doesn't matter if you have tenure. Okay, so Peter Duisberg, check his work out. More recently, Ignacio Chapela, also in the sciences. He found out there were traces of GMO corn that were beginning to hybridize with the native pristine corn crop, maíz, which is the national vegetable of Mexico, right? It was beginning to interbreed there. And, the Monsanto people and the Syngenta and Avartis, they have all these really synthetic names appropriately enough themselves. They came down on him like a sack of bricks, and he was up for a tenure, and he barely squeaked by. Again, that was my attorney, Dan Siegel, who represented him. And on and on, I can go on. So I'm making my point. There's really no academic freedom in the United States of America. And the people in the humanities and the history department who talk a big game about deconstructing the university or taking it back or in all this sincerity. And this includes your so-called cultural Marxists. They're full of beans. You know, they're talking through their hat.
Oh, yes.
Most of them. It's total jive. And you know who you are.
One thing that I've noticed about the educational system in America, especially at the so-called higher levels, and very good point about how the universities and colleges these days are just big psychiatric wards. Of course, that starts in grade school, where these poor autistic kids and vaccine-damaged kids then get hammered by Ritalin and Adderall and everything else as they get older. But when one looks back at the history of the U.S. and in England, we can see this pattern with the universities and the schools. One would think that a lot of the so-called atomic spies, a lot of the espionage agents in America in the 1950s and 60s and 40s were just disaffected people, kind of the rabble on the fringes. But actually, many of the spies that were recruited by first the earliest incarnations of the KGB, for example, OGPU, GPU, KGB,
and the GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence.
Often as not, these people were college students and college graduates, or they had come out of so-called finishing schools like Vassar College for women. You think of Ted Hall, Theodore Hall, atomic spy. He went to one of the Poison Ivy League colleges. And then you look across the pond to Great Britain. The KGB had a very good strategy. They knew that in the class-ridden caste system of British society, if they recruited the scions of these blue-blood elite families in university, that one day those recruited university students would wind up in the Ministry of Defense, would wind up in MI6, would wind up in the Foreign Office, and that's exactly what happened. And so the listeners must understand that from the beginning, I mean, for our purposes, going back at least 100 years, the universities have always been a hotbed of social engineering. And also, we must remember that the universities have always been weaponized. It's ironic, Daryl, when you think about all these SJWs running around, and they're so oblivious of history. You look at Dr. Lewis Jolin West, Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute, a notorious mind controller. He mind controlled Timothy McVeigh. He mind controlled Patty Hearst. He mind controlled just all these big names, just about people that have been set up as patsies and utilizing mind control. You look at how the UC system...
Wasn't he involved with Sirhan,
that's right.
Please continue, I'm sorry.
Yeah, whenever there was a big kind of case, a big court case, he was always, or oftentimes, the court-appointed psychologist, go figure, right? And then you look at how the University of California system was weaponized in a variety of ways, in bioweaponry research and nuclear weapons research, where basically the contract that was let from the U.S. government, the Manhattan Project, was given to the UC system. That's where they recruited a lot of their scientists, physicists, etc. So from the start, the universities were not only hotbeds of social engineering, espionage, subversion, but they were also involved in the development of weapons of mass destruction. And now they're just excreting all these SJWs. Now, as far as the ethnic standpoint is concerned, Daryl, and I'd like your thoughts about this, because I come from the Filipino perspective, and I see what colonization has done. First, the long occupation by the Spaniards, the imposition of Catholicism, all the guilt, all the shaming, all the torture, all the Inquisition. And then, what people don't realize, okay, and one would be hard-pressed to find a Filipino my age, and especially younger, I'm in my 52nd year, that knows what happened after Admiral George Dewey invaded the Philippines after the false flag event of the USS Maine battleship being blown up in Havana Harbor as a pretext to start the Spanish-American War. Of course, because Spain had colonized the Philippines for hundreds of years, that was a prime target. This was America's first expansionist overseas empire-building war. Well, unless you want to count what they did to Mexico. But as far as overseas was concerned, they invaded Cuba and they invaded the Philippines. And when you talk to most Filipinos today, they're completely oblivious about what the Americans did in the Philippines after they invaded in 1898 and into the early years of the 20th century. It was wholesale slaughter and genocide and rape. Entire villages of Filipinos were slaughtered. And they had the nerve, and they did the same thing in Iraq and in more recent times, they call it the Philippine insurrection because blame the victims, of course, right? Now, if you come across Filipinos my age or a bit older, my parents' generation, their only memory of a foreign occupation would be the Japanese occupation of World War II. But in sheer numbers, whatever the Japanese Imperial Army and Navy had done in the Philippines during the war years pales in comparison to what the Americans did, the wholesale slaughter meted out. Former Attorney General Ramsey Clark reckons that the Americans killed at least 1 million Filipinos during that time frame. And so
this is called the Philippine-American War in the history books.
Yeah, the Philippine-American War, which is another oxymoron because it was an invasion supposedly to liberate them from the Spaniards. But the point of relevance is this Falcara woman, or whatever her name is.
Falarca.
It's five will get you 10. She doesn't know that. She doesn't know about how career psychopaths like Colonel Edward Lansdale, Air Force officer, OSS veteran of World War II, torturer, had created a insurgency out of thin air, which history now knows, I'm sure you're familiar with this, Daryl, the Hukbalahap Rebellion in the Philippines. Basically, we've seen this shtick before, whether it's campesinos in Central America who just wanted land reform, agrarian reform, they just wanted more rights, while the Huk, so-called, in the Philippines were written off as communist insurgents. They send in Edward Lansdale. And to give an idea, folks, of just the kind of psychopath Edward Lansdale was, in the Philippines, they believe in a lot of supernatural things. And an asawang in the Philippines is what we would call a monster or a vampire. And Edward Lansdale was aware of these beliefs in the local populace, the regions that were being targeted, which they call the Hukbalahap Rebellion. So what Edward Lansdale would do is he would have his Philippine minions go out, kill innocent Filipinos, put a couple of puncture wounds in their neck, hang them upside down, and bleed them out. And then he would leave these bodies laying around, and then through his black propaganda network, put out this dark rumor about asawang vampires running around, attacking people and draining them of blood. All of it was a psyop, eventually to drive off and, if necessary, eradicate all the people who lived in the lands that were desired by these transnational corporations. So does this woman and all these other Asian Americans and all these other Filipinos, do they know that happened? Of course they don't. And then they moved Lansdale to Vietnam. Lansdale was at Dealey Plaza when Jack Kennedy was bumped off. Mm-hmm. So what we're dealing with, folks, is complete obliviousness, where just going back just a generation or two, all this information has gone into a memory hole. Another factor is we look back at the ancient Roman model. In the lands that they conquered, the tribes they conquered, and they expanded their empire, they began to take on what were known as auxiliaries. These were native warriors that were put into the Roman legions and fought for the Romans. And after 25 years of constant combat, if they somehow survived that, they were granted Roman citizenship. And a lot of these auxiliaries, they went at their work with zeal. They would often take Germanic tribes members from Europe, from Germany, bring them over to Britain when they were trying to subdue the British tribes. And so what we see in the Philippines and Vietnam and all these other places is the Asians were brought over. They were heavily indoctrinated. What I call the John Wayne programming. We liberated you from the Japanese. We freed you. Now we're giving you an opportunity. And in my case, what they did was, and this happened to many Filipinos, there was a law in the books that if a Filipino signed up with the United States Navy, they could then, after their term of enlistment was up, after a certain amount of time, they can apply for citizenship, right? Now, what people don't know is, for a lot of those Filipinos that signed up in the early 60s, the ink wasn't even dry before they sent them off to Vietnam, right? Because that's what happened. And it must be understood, folks, that if one is born into a military family, and let's say these controllers, by hook and crook, they damage a child with vaccines, they damage a child with medications, and then the concerned parents, in our example, we're talking about, say, Philippine parents, Navy dad, Philippine Navy mother, also counterparts in the Army, Marines, Air Force, etc. When a Navy doctor, let's say a captain, which is equivalent to a colonel in the Air Force or the Army, when a Navy captain says to a lowly petty officer, enlisted man, well, we think there's something going on with your child. Please bring him to this clinic. Make sure you give him these medicines, you know, at certain times of the day, certain times of the night. Bring him here, bring him there for specialist treatment. That's not a request, folks. That's a Navy captain ordering, basically, a lowly petty officer, first, second, or third class, and even up to the ranks of, in Army terms, captain, lieutenant colonel, major. All those people are grossly inferior in rank to a Navy captain, just using that as an example, because people and dependents from all branches of the service will go to, say, Bethesda Naval Hospital in the East Coast. They will go to Naval Medical Center in Balboa Park, San Diego. So one doesn't just have to be a Navy person to go there. They could be from all branches of the service. But the thing is the same. If a Navy captain doctor says to an Army major, bring your child here, bring it there, we need to do some scans, that's not a request. That's an order. And there's two things that are playing
in this James,
also.
Now, James, let me interrupt a moment. And correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't it true that if you do sign up with the military, you do give up your rights?
Yes.
So far, your own medical treatment. You are at the complete mercy of the military. Because it's a total institution.
It's a total institution. It's part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So
there you go.
Yeah, so when a Navy doctor, an Air Force doctor, whatever the case may be, says, because I want to make it clear to the people listening, this is not an example of my parents were in on it, okay? My parents were obedient and dangerously naive, a Navy couple. A dangerously naive, brainwashed Navy dad, dangerously naive, and an obedient Navy wife. So when these Navy doctors say, bring your son here for treatment, bring him there for treatment, give him these medicines, they're going to do it, and they're not even going to think twice about it. And so that's how they plug some of these people in, because they profile us, they track us, like he said earlier, Daryl, genealogy, right? Mm-hmm. To be sure, there are many countless examples of parents who were in on it. Okay, that element plays a role in this too. But one must understand where the Uniform Code of Military Justice is concerned, right? This is not doctor advice. This is like, these are orders. For example, if someone is sick in the military, they don't just call in. They have to show up in the Navy and Marine Corps. They show up at sick bay. They have to be examined that day, even if they're at death's door, to be given a certification, so to speak, in order to miss time. So everything is strictly regulated. And so, folks, I'm pointing this out. There's a sequence of events at work. People brought in from all these countries that have been invaded and otherwise intervened by the U.S. That's why when you go to ports of call in the U.S., be it Long Beach, Houston, San Francisco, L.A., you'll see large numbers of immigrants because of all these wars the U.S. has involved itself into. They keep bringing in these refugees from all these foreign countries. They flock to these ports of call. That's why places like California, there's so many Asians there. Like my old alma mater, which I was a college dropout. I dropped out, actually. San Jose State University. If you go onto their website and you look at all their past students, almost all of them are Asian. If you go to the community colleges in the San Francisco Bay Area, and many of them, if you look at their current and past student body, almost all of them are Asian. Because
there are communities that are predominantly Filipino-American, like Daly City, correct?
Oh, yes. I lived in Daly City, Daryl.
Oh, there you go.
I did.
Okay.
I lived two or three blocks away from the Cow Palace, right?
Yeah, I was just there a few months ago.
Yeah, so people have to understand that there's a wholesale influx, and they will talent spot, and they will recruit. And there is something, and we can say this because we're Asians, okay? And other people could just rant and rave about racism. And you know, people like you and I, Daryl, I know you go through it too. They don't really know what to make of us because, okay, first they try to sling the racism thing at us. Oh, you're just like a slant-eyed slope or whatever. They don't even know where that term comes from. But that mud doesn't stick. So then they spin it around. They say, oh, you're an Uncle Tom. You hate your own race. So they keep trying all these different things against people like you and I that are speaking out about this, but it just doesn't wash with us. because we see through all the BS. Also, from a higher dimensional perspective, we've been many races in our past incarnations. The whole concept of race baiting and divide and conquer via racism is patently absurd anyway. But anyway, yeah, I wanted to hear your thoughts about that, Daryl, about what I just mentioned.
Yeah, I'm trying to destroy Asian American studies from within. And that's the ultimate sin, because that's my department. We've outlived our usefulness. It might have been okay in the early days, but it's been infiltrated, it's commanded. In fact, there are faculty members, talk about Philippines, and, you know, your parents were working class, right? They're in military. But now they
Absolutely.
have these transnational elites coming from the Philippines who are teaching Asian American studies. We had this one woman who's down at UC Riverside. Her father was a diplomat from Singapore. She's Singaporean, Filipina. She grew up in German finishing schools, but she comes to the United States, goes to Berkeley, and all of a sudden she's an oppressed minority?
Yes.
And there's another guy there. He's also Filipino-American. He told me himself, by the way, I know them personally, and as soon as they see me within 5 minutes, they're confessing to me and spilling their guts because they know I'm for real and I can see through the soul of people who I meet. So this one guy told me, yeah, my dad worked for the World Bank. So his father was one of the ilustrados who sold out and pimped out the great wealth and the beauty of the Philippines to the World Bank, to these global institutions. So that is the state of Asian American studies now. And we have the same thing in all the different ethnicities, including the Japanese American. See, I'm old school. My people come from dirt, the fishermen, farmers, and all that. That was the old school Asian American studies. By the way, it's also happened in back African American studies, Latino studies. These are all now part of the elite control system on the basis of ethnicity. And the same goes true for your gay studies, GLBT, women's studies. It's been weaponized. It's been turned its head against all these groups. That's the irony. And these groups do not know that they're being played, especially if they're a 19-year-old person who's away from home for the first time, who has no context, and as you allude to, has no sense of the history.
Again, because I'm familiar with the Philippine background, the Spanish had intermixed with the native Filipinos, and then they created this hybrid caste called the mestizas, mestizos. These are basically people that, well, they're half white or they're half European, half Spanish. And you can tell by the surnames why so many Filipinos have last names like Della Rosario, like Rosales, all these Spanish
surnames. Or Rodriguez,
surnames.
Yeah.
Rodriguez. And what happened was, eventually, the landed peasantry, well, if they weren't entirely eradicated, they were just marginalized in some way or other. And the Filipino-Mestizo hybrid class, which emerged, became the oligarchy. We've seen this happen in many other countries. So even after the Spanish were kicked out and the U.S. moved in, there was this Filipino-Spanish demographic that controlled the sugar industry, that controlled the mining industry, the forestry industry, right? So it was still a landed oligarchy, which the Americans then tapped into, right, and controlled and manipulated for their own ends. So
we're talking about the elite American families. Right.
American families. Oh, yeah. Like
Rockefeller and the bankers and the
The governor general of the Philippines, William Howard Taft.
The Taft family.
Bones was the Taft family. People like that had spent considerable amount of time in the Philippines. And basically, that's where it all started, where they were talent spotting and recruiting these Filipinos, the scions, from the Spanish Filipino families. Many of them were sent to the U.S., worked in intelligence schools and trained in intelligence, trained in technology and whatever the case may be, and then they were spread out far and wide, and that's why so many today, why you see so many Filipinos, the sons and grandsons of that landed oligarchical elite, why they wind up in these ethnic studies courses as leading players in these ethnic studies movements.
Well, let me take it back to Berkeley, and James, I think we dovetail really nicely here, but UC Berkeley itself, that's the original University of California campus. There's 10 of them now. Davis is only one of, it started out as the agricultural station at UC Berkeley, so it's an old campus. But Berkeley itself, UC Berkeley itself was founded by Skull and Bonesman. You mentioned the Taft family, right? The first governor of the Philippines and later became U.S. president. But they sent their young men west because they knew that the Pacific and the treasures of Asia was where they needed to be, including China as the grand prize, right? So they built, they, meaning the architects, the planners, and this is where you get into the sacred geometry and the different occultic aspects of masonry, not Freemasonry, masonry building, right? And there's this woman by the name of Phoebe Hearst, right? You know the name Hearst as Philip Randolph. It's the same family. She was heavily into, which was appropriate to her class at the time, the late 19th century, early 20th century. She was heavily into the occultism, the genteel occultism of her social class. And Phoebe Snow had this planner, if I get into the architect, lay out the University of California on that hillside. Through her necromancer, or geomancer, let's say, she calculated, or her geomancer calculated, that the whole plan had to be shifted a few degrees left or right because they wanted the front of the University of California, the front, the face of the University of California, to be pointed directly at, guess what? The Philippines. Mm-hmm. Because the Philippines were going to be the gateway to the Asian wealth and the riches. And we're still fighting that war right now. We have China right now that there's all these double and triple games being played. So the University of California itself was aligned for that geomantically to for that specific purpose by these occultists.
Well, that's interesting, and it comes as no surprise because when we look at the Philippines strategically, and this is another thing that these SJWs from Philippine descendants don't know today, how Ferdinand Marcos, the corrupt Philippine dictator, was propped up for decades by the U.S., and then for decades, the Philippines was a hotbed of intrigue emanating out of the Subic Bay Naval Base Station, Clark Airfield, and the large CIA presence there working through. For example, the big backstory that about the whole fake 9/11 narrative, a lot of that started in the Philippines, where we're supposed to believe the Philippine National Police found evidence left behind by the infamous Ramzi Yosef that these terrorists were planning to hijack multiple airliners and crash them into landmarks of Western decadence, right?
That was Bojinka, right?
The Bojinka operation. We're supposed to believe that all happened. That was how it was planned. We're supposed to believe that the Philippine intelligence and the Philippine National Police found all this evidence, and that's about as cooked and doctored intelligence as one can imagine. And we see the same thing in Thailand, where we have the compliant Thai National Police, the compliant Thai intelligence apparatus, and all these other different countries in Asia that are beholden to the U.S. and corporate interests. They keep coming up with these phony narratives to justify all these interventions.
And what's interesting about Marcos is that he was fronting for an entire black budget. You know about Yamashita's gold, so forth, so-called.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's another show in itself. But, I mean, that's responsible for financing President Richard Nixon and any number of politicians through the black budget.
I'm sure you read the book, The Imperial Cruise. I forget the name of the author. But he talks about how the likes of William Howard Taft, Theodore Roosevelt, and others, they basically goaded Japan into an expansionist policy in Korea, in China, elsewhere. What they had in mind at the time was, and we have to remember, dear listeners, that a lot of this had to do also with the destruction of the Russian aristocracy, the Tsarist family, and replaced by the Bolshevik regime.
The Romanovs.
Yeah, the Romanovs. The Romanovs were gotten rid of. The Bolsheviks were brought in by the Rothschilds and the
Rockefellers. And the Bolsheviks originated in the U.S.
Yes, absolutely.
And sent back in there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that was Japan being goaded to wage war against Romanov Russia's Eastern Front. And so we see this continuum at work where they were using the Japanese as proxies, essentially, vis-a-vis Russia. During that time frame, when the Japanese had occupied China and South Korea, they were systematically looting a lot of these countries of their bullion, of their art, and their gold, and what have you. And as Daryl alluded to, Yamashita's gold, if you listeners could find it, it's an absolute classic in Black Ops, the real shadow world of intelligence.
Gold Warriors by Sterling gold and Piggy Seagrave. Yeah, it's still in print. Yeah,
Sterling Seagraves basically had to flee the U.S. because he was in fear for his life, because everyone was implicated. The Japanese royal family, General MacArthur, because the gold that was retrieved by people like Edward Lansdale, working with Philippine Army intelligence torturers, they tortured all these Japanese officers that knew where some of this gold was buried throughout the Philippines and Asia. Well, they made off with a lot of that gold, which they used to finance Black Ops, which they used to rig Japanese elections and just everything you could think of. Just think of what they could have done with all that gold. Well, they did it. And so that factors into this as well. Now, we're going to go over a little bit in this first hour, Daryl, because you and I, we could talk about this stuff for a bit. Before this first hour is up, did you want to talk about anything else? And then we'll segue. We're going to talk more about MyLab, mind control related issues, as it relates to the peculiar nature of the Asian character and the Asian mentality, which in a way lends itself, folks, to mind control. I don't even know if high consciousness a good way to describe it. All I can say as an example is that when Mao was foisted upon the Chinese after the U.S. backstabbed Chiang Kai-shek and hung him out to dry, and then they allowed Mao to take over what became
communist
China. By
the way,
Mao
was the creation of Skull and Bones.
Mao was a creation of Skull and Bones.
That's right. It called Yale in China. He was recruited. He was groomed. He was identified and brought forward. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, yes. And the OSS was working with the communist Chinese in Yunnan and other places. And a lot of the same OSS operatives, like Paul Helliwell, who worked with the communist Chinese, he morphs years later and becomes an anti-communist cold warrior. I mean, that's how crazy all this stuff is. But something happened, and I'd like your thoughts on this, Daryl. When you combine the Chinese character and their mindset of dealing with hardship, of dealing with famines, of dealing with floods, of the normality of losing children, you know, through illness, disease, whatever the case may be, and then you combine that with the communist hive consciousness, Maoist version of communism, it was a perfect storm, Daryl. It created this kind of Borg kind of mindset where organ harvesting, where mass genocide, starvation, the Great Leap Forward, just wiping out hundreds of millions of Chinese became the norm. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I don't want to ascribe susceptibility to these types of regimes to any one group, especially, you know, Asians. I think any group is susceptible to it. We've seen this through history.
Absolutely.
And but the big difference is the level of sophistication that has been brought in. And today, and maybe we'll talk about it later, the technologies, the techniques of mind control is much, much more refined than we see today in 2017. You mentioned people like Edward Lansdale. He was an advertising man out of San Francisco. His work, as pathbreaking as it was, by the way, he also did a psyops in Vietnam called Operation Wandering Ghost. Right, to play upon folk beliefs amongst Vietnamese people.
Oh, did the same thing there. Wow.
Right, yeah. The idea that if you don't find, if the head is removed from the body, the soul cannot rest. So create these atrocities, a psyops. Yeah, it's called Operation Wandering Soul because the body's not going to, or the soul's not going to rest because it's incomplete. But he was advertising them. His work there is child's play compared to what is taking place today, which uses a lot of 5G technologies, and everybody not me, but almost everybody has one of these, the latest iteration of the so-called smartphone. And we also see it in the smart grid cities. I had this flash this morning when I was preparing for our conversation today, that's what the sanctuary cities are. That's another one of those PR, Lansdalean type advertising terms that make you feel good. Sanctuary city, or United Nations, right? That comes right out of the advertising playbook. But sanctuary cities is nothing but smart grid. These are models of future American cities and global cities where you're all herded together in these compounds and controlled. That's really, so the immigration, that's what everybody's focusing on. Oh, there's so many immigrants. we have to clamp down on that, right? But there's a much, much deeper layer behind the whole so-called sanctuary cities. And researchers need to begin picking apart that whole notion and finding out about how it articulates sanctuary city, so-called, with Operation Jade Helm and Operation Urban Shield and all these plans that they're going to hurt us in these compact cities. This is all of a piece. So this is where it's important to have, as James has it under his belt, the historical perspective, the theoretical, know the different patterns so that you can see them, because they do recur. They're rebranded, they're relabeled. You know, it's a new pair of shoes, but it's the same old smelly socks that they're wearing. It goes even further back to pre-modernity, since we're talking about the Philippines, and without offending anybody, it really goes back to the Society of Jesus, right? One of the first people to go in there, to Japan, was Father Francis Xavier, and one of the shoguns had the, he was counseled by Dutchmen and other people saying, hey, the Jesuits, wherever they go, they're up to breaking up societies and doing the old Roman divide and rule pattern. So the daimyo kicked him out of the country. And so where did Francis, by the way, the current Pope's name, first time the Pope took the name of Francis, people think it's Francis of Assisi, right? The patron saint of animals? No, it's Francis Xavier who tried to break up Japan, and they serve, and that's one of the reasons why Japan, as small as it is still an economic powerhouse. But where did Francis Xavier go after he was kicked out? He went to the Philippines.
Yes.
So, and you have two different trajectories of economic development. One went down and one went up. So you have to go back to pre-modernity. We have to look at the Society of Jesus. And the reason why it's so relevant today is we're seeing that happen in the state of California, where we have a Jesuit-trained governor, right? Jerry Brown, his real name is Edmund Brown Jr., and his father. There's a whole family line there. He refused to listen to any sort of expert opinion about shoring up the dam system in California. That's why the Oroville Dam, which is the highest in the country, if it bursts, there'll be a million people affected, including me. Hopefully, it's not going to rain too hard over the weekend. As we found out through, not me, but Loren Moray, my esteemed friend and colleague, found out, the Castro, La Familia Castro, they're not Spanish. They're Iranian / Farnese family. That's Fidel Castro. His middle name was Alejandro, after Alejandro the Great. The Castro family owns a lot of California and a lot of the United States. Supposedly, he's a communist. Yeah, he's a communist, but under his direct familial rule that goes back into pre-modernity. So keep an eye on that one. Keep an eye on the Society of Jesus. Keep an eye on the Pope that's going on here. And keep an eye on the people that they have surrounded Donald Trump with.
There's a number of Goldman Sachs operatives that are in his administration already.
True.
Yeah, so we just have to see how that plays out. Well, this has been a fascinating first segment, Daryl. Could you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you and how they can find your work and your websites?
Absolutely. My publisher is Trine Day, and the publishing house features a number of really fantastic cutting-edge books, apart from mine. A recent title is by Sean Stone, the son of Oliver Stone, who did this great movie, Snowden, which is now available, I think, for rent. So you can check for my book there. It's Servitors of Empire, and it deals specifically with Asian and Asian American people who've been used as tools for the New World Order in certain fashion. You can look at Masaki Miyagawa of Al-Qaeda. He will help you with any sort of consultations you might need after listening to what we're talking about here. And I also wanted to give a shout-out to my colleague, Dr. Chuling Valverde. She's of Vietnamese background. She's fluent in Vietnamese, and she's very well known in her home country for the work that she's done. But anyway, she has spearheaded, because you know I'm about solutions too. I don't want to just indulge ourselves into submission here in negativity. But she has spearheaded what is called the Spirit Realm Initiative at UC Davis, and the idea there. And I'm working with her on this. You can find her on Facebook at Spirit Realm. It's open to the public. And what our intention here, in a nutshell, is to bring back discussions that James and I are having here to academia. We're going to do it in the university because it's heavily weighted to a very narrow vision of what human beings are, science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, as they call it. So we're going to bust it open, and we're also doing this as a way to defeat these so-called mental health compounds that are psychotropic drug-oriented and are pathologizing our young people and building a record on them that's not confidential, that'll follow them through their entire professional careers without their knowledge. All right. So in order to combat the psychiatric establishment, we are going to get back in touch with our universal spirit realm. And by universal, I mean that it's universal to all cultures and societies through time. The universities, UC included, have purposely chopped off that so important aspect of our humanity, of our species being. They have denied us access to this. So we're going to redress that. Look on Facebook, Spirit Realm. You could also find me on Facebook, Daryl Y. Hamamoto. I have a YouTube channel. It's called Professor Hamamoto. And no matter what the University of California tries to do with me, they will not be able to shut me up. Ideally, I want to be back in the classroom. By the way, if I could use this time, if you like what you hear, if you think Professor Hamamoto needs to be back in the classroom to teach Asian American, all people, all Americans, their real history, how it's been re-narrativized in a false fashion, then you could write to the chancellor of UC Davis. His name's Ralph Hexter, and his email address is chancellor, C-H-A-N-C-E-L-L-O-R, at ucdavis.edu. And I just got word today that there is a political figure of national stature who wants to help publicize my situation at UC Davis, because it's not about Professor Hamamoto alone. It's about freedom. It's about intellectual inquiry. It's about the openness of varied forms of investigation of inquiry, such as being done by James Bartley. Thank goodness we have the internet. Otherwise, he would have been completely shut out of it. And it's through programs like him that we are going to be recovering the different aspects of our life, institutionalized, whether it's in the military, the university, you name it. We're going to recover it. We're going to open it up and reintroduce our human heritage to ourselves through top-flight thinkers such as James, scholars, artists, athletes, you name it. That's how we will make America great again. That's how we'll make the world great again. And this is how we will eventually defeat these forces that have been aligned against us for hundreds of years.
Yes, this is, the battle has been joined. This is spiritual warfare manifesting on the physical plane. And I'm so grateful that you're out there standing in the gap, Daryl, because we need more people in the universities doing your kind of work. There's a lot of people out there, I'm sure, in their own kind of covert way in the universities. They're trying to help, but you're one of the very few out there that have been very public about it and have been standing in the gap. One more comment I want to make before we end the first part here. The comment I made about the Chinese-Americans, well, not Chinese-Americans, but Chinese and the communists, I want to emphasize, too, it's kind of a disclaimer, but I'm descended from the Chinese as well. My maternal grandmother was half Chinese. I've got Spanish-Portuguese blood and Philippine blood. I'm not all Filipino, so I've got this kind of mishmash thing going on. What happened to the Chinese with communism, we can see the same thing rebranded happening elsewhere throughout the world, what they've done in the madrasa schools, churning out all these Taliban, churning out all these people, pushing Sharia law, which is also being pushed by the universities, of course. It's all about social engineering and kind of changing America from the inside out and the whole world in general. So I mentioned China because it was such a large country with so many people that suffered such hardship. The hundreds of millions of people who were murdered and starved to death as a result of the Mao communist regime. And then we think of the Bolshevik regime and the hundreds of millions of people there who starved and was murdered, and what happened to the Ukrainians. It's collectivism writ large, and that's what they're trying to push with the Agenda 21 and this false sustainability, folks, is it's collectivism all over again. Anyway, we are solutions-oriented, and we're going to talk more about solutions-oriented things in the second half. We've reached the end of the first segment, a fascinating segment. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.